From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in orphanages after World War II. British psychiatrist and psychoanalyst John Bowlby was working with children who, he said, were not thriving. Bowlby noticed that even though the children were given good food, medical care, and housing, many died. He was perplexed by the situation and how child development theories of the time could not really explain it. Throughout the next several decades, Bowlby immersed himself in research projects and developed what is now known as attachment theory. To sum it up, attachment theory explains that because human babies are born essentially helpless, their instincts drive them to search for a reliable caregiver and to attach themselves to that caregiver. It can be a parent, usually a mom, but not always. It can be a grandparent, a nanny, or any adult that's constant and present in the child's life and provides for his or her basic physical and emotional needs. If the child finds that caregiver and his or her needs are consistently met, the baby develops a secure attachment to that caregiver. If the baby is unsuccessful in finding a reliable caregiver, it results in an insecure attachment. The attachments that we form as children shape our emotions, personality, and expectations for relationships. And this carries on into adult lives, in romantic relationships with friends, our managers, our coworkers, and others. This hour, we're going to discuss attachment theory and the different types of attachment with a man who spent years studying the theory and his own attachment style. Author Peter Lovenheim wrote about his experiences and what he learned in a new book called The Attachment Effect, exploring the powerful ways our earliest bond shapes our relationships and lives. He's my guest for the hour, and Peter, it's always nice to talk to you. Welcome back to the program. How are you?
Evan, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back here.
Can I just say
that was like one of the best summaries of attachment theory I've ever heard, what you just gave. That was great.
Well, you can credit producer Megan Mack. She and I have been diving into the attachment effect and had a conversation about, you know, how far back this goes here, because I think I want to do a couple of things at the outset is remind our listeners, when you hear attachment effect, you might think immediately of, attachment parenting. And Peter's book actually has a section that my brain went to immediately, which was the Time magazine cover a few years ago of a mother breastfeeding like a four-year-old who's standing up tall and breastfeeding and talking about, you know, real strong attachment. So this is not just attachment parenting. This is about the attachment effect and how it impacts all of our relationships, all of them, which was fascinating to me.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to take this way beyond just parenting,
yeah.
Although, as you say, there is a chapter on that, to show how this affects individuals throughout life in all the ways you described, in relationships with friends, with spouses, romantic partners, with children, with aging parents, at work with colleagues, on sports teams with teammates and coaches, even with political leaders. I have a chapter on politics. And in it, by the way, Mayor Lovely Warren of Rochester is mentioned, so maybe we can get to that too.
All right. So, and I want to do a couple of other things for our listeners to kind of dive in here, because I want you to sort of remember who we're talking to in Peter. This is a guy who wrote a book. One of my favorite books of the last decade was written by Peter Lovenheim. It was a book called In the Neighborhood, and it was a story that is so familiar to so many of us, not really the grisly, gruesome, tragic parts of it, which started with, if I'm remembering, a murder and a murder-suicide?
Yes, on my street.
On your street. But Peter, you know, is someone who lived in a suburban neighborhood. There's a murder-suicide on the street, not that many houses down, and yet neighbors are kind of looking at each other going like, boy, we really didn't know that family that well. And it made me think of my street, and it made probably so many readers think of their street. How many people actually know our neighbors? And anyway, not to belabor the point, but Peter's book I thought was really powerful because he actually spent time doing overnights with his neighbors and trying to get to know them. And it reminded – I just thought it was really observant. And it was to me, it was an insight into the way your mind works. And so now here you are with the attachment effect. Not surprised that you're observing relationships in different ways here.
Right. And thank you for those comments. But The topics are related because in my book, In the Neighborhood, I was looking at the connections we have with the people who were physically closest to, our neighbors. But in the attachment effect, I think I found through attachment theory the real source, the real heart of how we connect to each other, and that is through relationships. So this book is really a very broad extension of the idea that I've been studying for a long time.
If you had written The Attachment Effect first, you could have done In the Neighborhood and then done the attachment quizzes, with all of your neighbors to
that,
see it.
That would have been interesting.
but now I want to go back and read the book and say, oh, this neighbor is earned secure. This neighbor is, you know, it's fascinating stuff. But let's talk about why you did this book, because you went through 5-6 years ago a lot in your own life, and you had questions about kind of your own background and kind of what led to the where you were in life, right?
Right. And this is personal, but I do put myself into the story in some places. After a 20-year marriage, I was in a new relationship, but it was like riding an emotional roller coaster. There were lots of ups and downs and breakups and makeups, and I was puzzled by that because I had not experienced that before. And then I was visiting my daughter, Valerie, at college one day and just leafing through her psychology textbook, and I came across this thing called attachment theory. I had not heard of it before. But in one section, the authors described what can happen when two people with what they called opposing attachment styles try to become a couple. And they said there can be lots of ups and downs and breakups and makeups, and the relationship can be explosive. And they went on to describe to a T what I'd been experiencing. I was intrigued, and I just wanted to learn more. And that was 7 years ago.
I want to warn you, if you read Peter's book, The Attachment Effect, you will, as you go, start analyzing and reanalyzing yourself, your relationships, your coworker relationships, your friendships. It's going to, and in some ways, I think it could be very helpful for you. It was very instructive to me because this is a country where if you think, well, you know, a lot of infants probably do have at least somebody in their life for the first 18 months, 24 months, who is there consistently. Here are the numbers, if I'm remembering from your book offhand, 55% of people are in a category that would indicate that they did have an attachment early in life that was consistent, reliable, healthy. But
yes.
45%, not really. And that breaks down in different ways for us as we get older. Is that kind of, am I remembering correctly?
Right. About 45% of adults in the general population would have what's called an insecure attachment of a couple different types. Included, by the way, in that is about 5% of people who have what's called disorganized attachment. That's the worst place to be. And that results usually from an infant experiencing neglect or maltreatment. And as I say, in the general population, that's just about 5%. But in populations where parents are stressed by poverty, paternal depression, and other factors, that number can be as high as 60 to 80%.
And so we don't necessarily think about it as we go throughout our lives. But what happened in those first 18 to 24 months really does matter. And it's not just a mom. In your own life, this bears out. It's not just, did you have a mom who breastfed and stayed home and did all of these things? It can be different people.
Right.
And in your life, that was the case.
There does have to be some consistent caregiver during those first 18 months to 2 years. But the role is not gender specific. It can be the dad. It can be a grandparent. It can be a nanny or some other adult.
And so Peter's book examines what we know about what happens to us when that does happen, what happens when that doesn't happen, what we become as adults, and then this is to me the big key, can we change? Can we say, hey, I have, you know, sort of I'm in the avoidant category, or I'm in the anxious category, which means I'm always seeing threats to my relationships. I'm always assuming the worst. Or if I'm avoidant, maybe I don't want to open myself up to intimacy. I don't want to open myself up to close friendships. I'm scared of rejection. I'm just going to shut down. We all know these people. Maybe we're that way ourselves. Maybe we're in relationships with those people. And the question becomes, then can we change? Because some people are going to say, well, of course, Peter Loewenheim wrote this book. You're in the secure category, you know, and it's easy for you, but not necessarily the case, right?
Well, no, that's not necessarily the case. But the short answer to your question is, yes, we can change. And two, even if we don't change, new studies show that people who have avoidant or anxious attachments also have some very unique traits that they can bring to, say, their role at work, which is important to know about because these people have important contributions to make as well.
I think that's important not only for Peter to point out, but for me as the interviewer, I don't mean to create this idea that, well, categorically, if you're in the secure category, you know, you're in the good category. It's not just, you know, it's not good, bad, it's life. And there are absolutely assets for people who are anxious. They see threats, real threats, more quickly than maybe other people would.
Right. Here's a very interesting study that just recently came out. So researchers had a group of people, all of whom had known attachment styles. They put them in a room and asked them to look at the screen on a computer. But then the researchers created this fake crisis where they had smoke coming out of the computer as if there was a fire. What they found was the people with anxious attachment were the first ones to detect the threat. And the people with avoidant attachment were the first ones to find a way out of the room. So from this kind of study, we take away the lesson that, for example, if you've got a group of people at work, you want some people with both of those special skills because they are going to add benefits for the whole work group. And in fact, there was another study showing that the very most productive work groups are not those that just have people who have secure attachment, but have a diversity of attachment styles. It's a whole new take on this quest for diversity in the workplace. We now really should start thinking about having diversity of attachment styles.
My guest is Peter Lovenheim, the author of In the Neighborhood, and his new book is The Attachment Effect. It is available now, and you can meet Peter on Wednesday night at the Pittsford Barnes & Noble at 7 p.m. What are you doing there on Wednesday?
I'll be talking about the book in more depth, talking about how attachment styles affect us in areas like dating, at the workplace, in politics, with our own parenting, and answering questions and signing books.
7 p.m., Barnes & Noble, Wednesday night for that. And this book really does impact all of us. I as I said earlier, and I'll say it again, I learned a lot, and it made me sort of take a fresh look at how I interact with people in a lot of different spheres. So what I want to do now is kind of move kind of section to section of different parts of our lives, because the attachment effect really does impact us. And let's start with those relationships, whether it's a marriage or dating relationship, and how you know, by the way, what category you or a person is in. You can actually take sort of a shorter quiz or a longer, but you can kind of determine it through a basic quiz.
Right. And one of the points I emphasize in the book is it is very important to learn our own attachment style, because if we have that knowledge, we can better understand how it is we're relating to the people who are most important to us in our lives. And if we have problems through insecure attachment, we can learn to work around them. So in the book, I have what's called the attachment quiz. It's just a quick, 30 questions that somebody can take in 5 minutes. It'll give you a pretty good sense of your own attachment style.
And by the way, when you hear us describing different terminology this hour, let's do a quick explainer.
Okay.
So secure attachment means what?
Secure attachment describes people who came out of early childhood having received consistent responsive care from the primary caregiver. As adults, people with secure attachment tend to be trusting of others, comfortable with intimacy. They have high self-regard, but not to an inflated extent. And when they're faced with setbacks such as illness or injury or the loss of a loved one, they tend to show a great deal of resilience.
Avoidant attachment.
When a caregiver consistently fails to provide an infant sensitive, responsive care, that infant generally comes out of early childhood with what we call an avoidant attachment. And as adults, people with this attachment style tend not to trust others so much, to feel uncomfortable with intimacy. In fact, they often wonder, like, what's the deal, big deal with relationships? Why do I even want to be in a relationship? Instead, they strongly prize their self-reliance and independence.
Anxious attachment.
When an infant receives inconsistent care, sometimes it's there, sometimes it isn't. Care that's sensitive and meets the infant's emotional and physical needs. That infant can come out of early childhood with an anxious attachment. And as an adult, people with this attachment style tend to crave intimacy, yet at the same time, they don't trust their relationship partners to really love them and be there for them. So their relationships have kind of a push-pull quality. And they also lack resilience. So when they're faced with a setback, such as a relationship breakup or personal illness or loss of a loved one, they don't do so well with that.
And disorganized.
Well, this is the worst place to be. It's really a combination of anxious and avoidant. As I said, it often results from a neglectful or maltreatment during infancy. It happens because the same person who the infant is looking to for help and protection is also the same person who's threatening or harming that infant. And this is an impossible situation for an infant to cope with. These people grow up really unable to regulate their own emotions and to have a great deal of difficulty in all kinds of relationships. If this type of attachment style is not corrected in some way, these people will have a difficult time succeeding in school. Disorganized attachment is a predictor for delinquency and even later on violent criminality.
And so this is the part of your book that actually had me thinking about the word privilege. We talk a lot about privilege and advantage in society, and some people get sick of it. Some people think that we're too obsessed with identity. And I understand it, and we're going to try to have nuanced conversations because I don't think it's all one direction or another. I think there's nuance in that conversation. But this is a place where you fall on this spectrum is derived from something that had nothing to do with your own merit. It's whether you had a caregiver, not when you were 6 or 10 or 12 or 18, but the first 2 years of your life, who was consistent, there for you, nurturing and loving. And it breaks your heart to hear people who are struggling because of those things.
Well, getting back to this disorganized attachment, which I said results from maltreatment or neglect, and also is a byproduct of parents who are struggling with issues of poverty or depression. We're fortunate in Rochester to have a facility at the Mount Hope Family Center, which has done groundbreaking work in working with these kids and their parents to help them overturn the disorganized attachment that they came out of early childhood with. They've had remarkable results. And one thing I advocate in the book is greater public support, that is through funding, for these programs like at Mount Hope Family Center and others around the country.
And understandably so. So you are someone who 20 or 25 years ago would have been in what category?
I grew up with an anxious attachment,
Anxious attachment. And you're pretty open in the book about what you've been through personally.
Well, I don't really like putting that much of myself
out
there in
public.
But, I mean,
this is really part memoir.
But I felt, yes, it is. And the reason I did that is I felt that I'm taking sort of complex ideas from academic areas as diverse as evolutionary biology and social psychology, and trying to present it to the general reader in an accessible, even engaging way. I felt to make that happen, I needed to tell a lot of stories in the book, including my own. So I do begin the book by telling my own story, how my dad was my primary caregiver, how I probably came out of early childhood with less than perfect experience of caregiving for different reasons. And I hope that by telling that story honestly, readers will be able to identify and think about their own situations. One thing I did was I took what's called the adult attachment interview, which is really the gold standard for measuring attachment in adults. It's an hour-long interview consisting of 20 questions that probe very deeply about how a person can narrate their own early family experiences. And the surprise ending, actually, for me, of that chapter was that the person who administered this interview to me said that actually I was not anxious anymore, but had what's called an earned secure attachment. And this is available, you know, to lots of people.
People, you can change.
Yes. And this often is a result of, for some people, being lucky enough to have a mentor as they're growing up. Could be a teacher or a sports coach. It could be the result of working in therapy to try to understand one's personal background. It can also sometimes be the result of being paired up with, perhaps through marriage, a person who has a secure attachment. In my case, the person who assessed me as earned secure felt that probably my own experience of parenting had a big effect on my ending up earned secure.
There's also a thread throughout the book as you talk about being earned secure in your attachment, moving from anxious attachment to secure attachment. One of the threads was your self-awareness of it, how comfortable you are just being introspective about your life. And what makes me a little nervous is that most people, understandably so, aren't really thinking that deeply about these issues. Most people would not say, yeah, oh, I'm avoidant secure or I'm anxious secure. That most people would probably say, no, I'm fine.
Yeah. You know,
and so what worries me is this book focuses on the importance, the huge importance of 0 to 24 months, the first 2 years, and then the work that you have to do to undo damage if there is damage. It doesn't matter if your kid's 4, 5, 6, and things start to change.
Well, I'll tell you one of the stories I tell in the book. I started my research for this book actually by sitting in on a class at the University of Rochester taught by Professor Harry Reese about attachment. And Harry and I would meet every couple months at a coffee shop to go over my progress on research. So one day we're sitting at the coffee shop and we're talking about how anxious attachment might affect somebody doing online dating. When the woman at the next table over turns around and actually almost shouts at us, she says, I'd be paying to sit at your table. What you're talking about is so important. I wish I knew that when I was younger. It would have saved me a heap of grief. And that's when I first thought, well, maybe there is an audience for this book. And I tell the story because I think that, as you say, some people don't think about this stuff at all. But people with anxious attachments actually do think about it. That's part of what it is to have an anxious attachment. In fact, the term is often another term for anxious attachment sometimes is preoccupied. People with this attachment style tend to be preoccupied. They think a lot about their upbringing and how they got to how they are. So like this woman at the table next to us, I think there are actually a lot of people who think about these things and would benefit by understanding how attachment plays a role in their life and knowing their own attachment style.
And so in compatibility with couples, avoidant and anxious, is that the toughest pair?
Yeah, that's sometimes called the anxious-avoidant trap. That's actually what I was in when I was in the relationship and started this book. That's a tough pairing because the anxious person, as I noted, is sort of craving more intimacy and constantly wanting reassurance about the relationship, whereas the avoidant person doesn't feel comfortable being that intimate and will move away, which only causes the anxious person to come closer. And they end up having this kind of dance, which is, you know, it's really hard to find the sweet spot. It's not that it can't be done, but both people in that pairing would really have to understand what they're dealing with and be committed to working it through.
There's a lot of hot and cold in those kind of relationships, on and off.
Yeah, a lot of breakups and makeups and ups and downs and turbulence, and it can be explosive.
And for you, did you ultimately decide that trap, the anxious avoidant trap, was too much?
Well, typically in that kind of trap, it's the avoidant person who finally pulls the plug.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's That was typical.
Okay. And but now, again, you've migrated to this earned, secure place where you're not as anxious anymore. And I wonder now if you think it's valuable for people who would probably guess they're secure to take this quiz that's in the book, to really think about it, and to think about, you know, what happens in a relationship. You know, every couple deals with challenges. I don't like the word fight, but people say, everybody fights or whatever it is. But why do you fight? Why do you argue? Or why do you disagree when you do? What styles of disagreeing?
Yeah, there's a whole area of couples counseling called, I can't think of the name right now, emotionally focused therapy. Thank you. EFT. That was developed by Dr. Sue Johnson in Ottawa, Canada, based on attachment theory. And this has been shown to be remarkably successful with couples who are having troubles in their partnership. The reason it works so well is emotionally focused therapy doesn't teach couples, you know, how to argue better or how to fight fair or anything like that. It looks at each of their attachment needs, recognizes that romantic relationships, when they succeed, fulfill our attachment needs, and helps the couple understand how they can be each other's secure base and provide a secure attachment to each other.
My guest is Peter Loewenheim, who is the author of the brand new book, The Attachment Effect, Exploring the Powerful Ways Our Earliest Bond Shapes Our Relationships and Lives. You can meet Peter and listen to him tell you more about The Attachment Effect Wednesday night, 7 p.m. at the Pittsford Barnes & Noble for a free event out there. Books will be there, and so will Peter. We're going to get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, I want to talk about the way The Attachment Effect impacts other relationships at work. You mentioned you want to talk a little politics. We'll talk
I do.
Yeah. We'll talk politics.
Okay.
We'll talk about I think it's important to talk about aging and loss and the way different people deal with different things. Peter's gone through a lot in his life, and he opens up and shares a lot with The Attachment Effect, but this is something that impacts all of us. So let's get that only break and come right back with Peter. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, okay, we can rib the president for not knowing that it was the British and not the Canadians who burned the White House in the War of 1812. But polls show most Americans don't know much at all about Canada. Why is that? Our panel of Canadians will enlighten us about their country. Then in our second hour, the future of the Cadillac Hotel and the people who have lived there, a conversation about housing in Rochester. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we dive into some other aspects of where the attachment effect impacts our lives, on the subject of dating, there's a couple of things here that Peter and I were just talking about during the brief break. Number one, Peter wanted to mention that if you're thinking about EFT, emotionally focused therapy, there are counselors in Rochester certified in that?
Yes, yes. And I have a place in the book where you can go to a website and find people in Rochester who are certified to do emotionally focused therapy with couples or actually with an individual as well.
And I like there's a section in the book where you say, you know, this is going to sound a little gauche at first, but we're going to explain, that you say you actually on a first date can start to look at, start to try to analyze this person who I'm out on a date with. What part of the spectrum of attachment would they be on? Now, that doesn't mean you're literally, hi, thanks for having a drink with me. Here's a quiz. Take this quiz. But you're looking for different cues. And I thought, if I'm remembering from the book, let's see if I remember some of them, because some of these are so vivid. And it doesn't even have to be a date. It could be somebody you just met at work, somebody who comes into the office. To me, it's the oversharer, the super personal detail sharer, somebody who's kind of looking for validation or the awe or I'm so sorry, someone who constantly wants some kind of a feedback or validation of emotion.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with sharing, being open. No one's saying being open is bad, but the person who on the first time you meet them or the second time you meet them is all of a sudden telling you really personal details, you go, whoa.
Well, on a first date, a person who has an anxious attachment would have a tendency to over-disclose. This person has such a craving for intimacy that he or she would sort of jump the gun on intimacy and kind of assume a closeness that doesn't exist yet. So oversharing would be a sign of an anxious attachment. On the other hand, a person with an avoidant attachment on a first date would really want to talk about anything but themselves on a personal level. So they'll talk about work, sports, real estate, you know, anything but self-disclosing. Whereas a person with a secure attachment would kind of hit that, you know, Goldilocks spot, would share just about right, not too much, not too little, and in the process probably make you feel quite at ease with the conversation.
So the person who canceled on you twice and finally shows up and is checking their phone for sports scores all night?
Avoidant. Avoidant, yeah. And you know, just to say, there's not. I mean, people with avoidant and anxious attachments can have wonderful relationships. It's just that, as the professor at the U of R put it to his students, you know, if you can meet someone who's secure, you're five steps ahead. Why not?
Yeah, and with avoidant, I actually, in reading the sections on relationships, I thought that would be the most difficult because at least with anxious attachment, that person wants closeness, intimacy. Avoidant can be the kind of person who seems like they actually don't. And what's the analysis for someone who might say, oh my gosh, I'm taking this quiz and I'm kind of avoidant, but wait, I want relationships. I want closeness. Yeah. I don't think of myself as someone who doesn't.
We should mention that these categories are not totally cut and dried.
Yeah,
I mean, there are degrees.
It's a real spectrum.
Right. So people can be highly avoidant or a little avoidant. And a person who's a little avoidant is still going to enjoy relationships and learn to trust and learn to self-disclose. But they just might have to push themselves a little bit more to do it.
Listener named Rob wants to know, what about accountability when it comes to attachment theory? How does a lack of accountability in a relationship by one or both parties fit into attachment theory? Is one attachment style more likely to not be accountable than another?
I'm not sure I understand what the listener's saying about accountability.
Sounds to me, I assume accountability means just being open to one's flaws and you know, admitting mistakes, or at least, you know, being willing to give, you know, sort of give in a relationship. As one person, is there one part of the spectrum where someone is less likely, more likely to be selfish and a little more myopic?
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's a function of attachment style, to be honest.
It's a different part of psychology.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, attachment is very important. That's why I spent 7 years writing this book. But even so, it's not everything. There are other aspects that play into personality.
Important, yeah, because you can be accountable or lack accountability in probably all parts of the spectrum.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Rob, for that. Let's go beyond relationships, though. And let's hit a couple of different things here. At work. You mentioned this book is not a how to become secure and how to beat yourself up if you're not, because there are benefits to anxious attachment, to avoidant. But at the same time, if we're looking at our work relationships, there are some potential pitfalls we could have if we have anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, and that I think being self-aware may help us. How do you think it helps at work?
You know, first of all, let me say the studies suggest that secure people actually do make the best managers and supervisors. So if you have a manager at work who's, you know, maybe not functioning that well, it might be a factor. You know, that person's attachment style could be a factor. But as far as is all the rest of us, the avoidant person at work is going to be less comfortable working on a team. And if he or she knows they're avoidant, and if the supervisor knows that, then everybody can benefit if that person is given a lot of independent projects to work on, rather than being required always to work on a team. On the other hand, an anxious person will want to be part of a team, but while part of that team, may be constantly looking for reassurance that everybody else values his or her work. So again, if a manager understands that a particular employee has an anxious attachment, that might be something where he or she can just give that employee more reassurance and make that person feel more comfortable as part of the team. So these are ways of increasing productivity by understanding attachment style in the workplace.
And that had me thinking of James Fallon's book, not Jimmy Fallon. It's a different James Fallon. He's a neuroscientist who was on this program after he realized that he himself has psychopathy. So it was about him acknowledging through his own brain scan, oh, I'm a psychopath. Now, a psychopath is sort of a shorthand term in popular culture for a killer or something. But psychopathy is just an understanding of someone's chemistry that they lack empathy for others. And so not all people with psychopathy, not all psychopaths are violent to others or dangerous to others. They just don't really have the capacity to care what others are experiencing. But as Fallon pointed out, there are a lot of CEOs who have mild psychopathy, nonviolent psychopathy, because they are bottom line driven. They will take down whatever obstacles are in front of them to benefit the company in the bottom line, and they actually end up in the corner office. And I wonder if there's an attachment style that you think is more likely to end up in a CEO's position.
I would guess that many CEOs have an avoidant attachment.
That's what I was
thinking. Because they so prize independence and self-reliance, and also they're not as much, encumbered by needing to be with their loved ones. They travel very well.
Yep.
You know, they may not actually make the best managers, but they probably are overrepresented among entrepreneurs.
That was my guess. I mean, they may not make the best managers, as in you may find yourself loathing them, but they may be offering good returns for the company's bottom line. Now, it's really interesting to just think about the attachment effect and these different attachment. I was going to say style. It's not style. What's the term? The different attachment profiles,
well,
I guess.
Usually use style or type.
Yeah, type or profile, because, again, it's what happened to you in the first 2 years of your life. Did you have a caregiver, usually a mother, but not always? Did you have a consistent figure who was loving, responding, nurturing, and consistent? And if the answer is no, then your attachment profile is going to be different, more likely than not. And what Peter's book demonstrates is with awareness and with work, you can change it. So you even see it in politics. And this is the part of the book that I arrived in and I went, wait, really? In politics? But you think so?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, because it's hard for us to believe, but politicians were once children too. You know, so they grew up with an attachment type, and that attachment type is going to influence their decision making and behavior once in office. I had an article recently in Politico looking at the likely attachment style of President Trump and how that may be playing out while he's in office. And I also had the opportunity, since I spend a good part of the year in Washington, D.C. now, to ask questions from the adult attachment interview of a number of current and former members of Congress to see what their attachment styles were. I was able to give the full adult attachment interview to one former presidential nominee, Michael Dukakis, former governor of Massachusetts. And I was able to give the adult attachment interview questions to the mayor of a very important forward-looking and progressive city that means an awful lot to me, which is Rochester. And Mayor Warren was kind enough to sit with me for an hour and let me ask her these questions. As I report in the book, almost all the politicians who I interviewed showed a likely avoidant attachment style, with one exception, and that was Mayor Warren. And I think that's a very, it's a positive thing about Rochester that we've elected a mayor here who has a secure attachment. And the reason that's important is because, politicians with any attachment style can be successful in office, can be effective leaders to an extent. But the researchers say that it's only politicians with secure attachment who have the potential to become truly transformational leaders, to truly, you know, lift up the whole populace and help us all improve the society. So I was glad to see that Mayor Warren has that. And I think, you know, whether we're Republicans or Democrats, it's always nice to see that a person elected to office has at least the potential for transformational leadership. In her case, it's probably too early to tell. She's still young. She's still relatively new in office. But that was an important finding and one I was glad to report on in the book.
Now I want to turn, as we get towards the back part of the hour, to where a lot of people probably think that, the book starts, because The Attachment Effect is not a book about attachment parenting. That is a phrase that is very popular in the culture now, and I would guess for most of our listeners, it brings to mind a debate about helicopter parenting, about some of the so-called mom wars about, are you overly attached? Are you ever letting your child out of your sight? Can you overdo it? Well, Peter's book does go into that Time magazine cover on the mother who's breastfeeding like a 3 or 4 year old, and you take some stock of the idea of co-sleeping and different things that parents are doing to try to create constant closeness. Let me start by asking you how you feel about the line, that Time magazine cover and related issues. How does it strike you?
Well, it's a little off-putting to see a 4-year-old standing up nursing from his mother. I think the boy was wearing camouflage pants and high-top sneakers. But they used that picture because it was meant to get people's attention and buy the magazine. And it did. I make the point in the book that the important thing is that we raise, we have to understand that when we raise our children, we are fostering an attachment style in that individual, which in all likelihood will follow them throughout their life and influence all relationships that they have. So raising a human being is a really serious thing to do, and it's worth paying attention to try to do it right in attachment terms. However, that does not mean being with our children 24/7. It doesn't mean hovering. What it means, I think, to simplify, is just two things. First, consistency. There has to be some person, it's usually the mother, but it's not a gender-specific role. It could be the dad or grandparent. There has to be somebody who is consistently available to that child for the first 18 months to 2 years to give them reliable protection and comfort. The second thing is we have to learn to read our children's signals in order to respond appropriately. So we have to be close enough to them and often enough to learn the difference, for example, between different cries, between the I'm tired cry, I'm hungry cry, I'm fine but I just want to keep playing cry, or the, I'm terrified and I don't want to be alone cry. And the practices that attachment parenting promotes are, people go overboard with it, but actually they're pretty good ways to stay close enough to our infants in order to learn to read their signals correctly. So, for example, breastfeeding is a way that moms can be physically close enough to their child to learn their signals. Baby wearing, I find that just a strange term, but it means, carrying an infant in a sling or carrier rather than pushing them always in a stroller is another way to keep a kid close. Co-sleeping is a third way. Some people interpret that to mean having the child in bed sometimes with you. Other people interpret it to mean just having the child in the bedroom, maybe for the first few months.
And I know some doctors and pediatricians would really caution against co-sleeping. So I know that's probably a whole separate discussion on safety.
Well, if you interpret it to mean just having the child in the bedroom, then that's another way of being close enough to learn to correctly read the child's signals.
Sure. And we got an email from a listener named Andrew who wanted to know, can you overdo it? Can you make a child unable to be independent later in life by making them too reliant?
I think you definitely can do that. I'm not sure with an infant, maybe up to 6 months, that's a concern. But after that, yes, a child needs to have some time to become a little more independent and self-confident.
My son was 9 months old. I remember I had a conversation with him. I said, you just take all the time. What do you contribute to the world? when are you going to give back to Andrew, I take the point in the email, but I want to remind you that when Peter Loewenheim is writing about the attachment effect, he's not talking about 4 years old, 6 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old, where I think Andrew's concern is, are we babying a child and making them sort of unable to handle adversity. We're talking about when the child is not able to care for themselves at all, and can that child develop a consistent expectation of love and care and response?
Yes. I mean, I think if we talk about older children, it's important to remember that they need attention too. They don't need our physical, you know, contact so much. But there's a study that I completely love. I want to share it for a moment. So 50 children aged 3 and above were told to run twice around a baseball diamond as fast as they could. While they ran, their parent was told to stand in the third base coaching box. And for one of the two runs, parents watched their children. And for the other run, parents were told to stare at their phones. So what do you think the result was? When parents watched their children, the kids ran faster and fell less often. But when parents stared at their phones, they ran more slowly and they stumbled more. And interestingly, it made no difference if the attentive parents cheered or just watched quietly. The key was that they were present and paying attention. And I think that's a real lesson we can take in how we raise kids of whatever age. You know, bottom line is they do need to feel they have our attention.
They have our attention. They're secure. It was just last week on this program, had a wonderful comment from a pediatrician responding to screen time guidelines saying that he will tell his children, look, I've got to do some work for 10 minutes on my phone and then you will have my attention, as opposed to just sort of surreptitiously trying to do it or doing it all the time. And the child notices, well, that parent's always on their phone.
Yeah.
No, I take that point. And so, Andrew, thank you for the email on that.
The other point, yeah. By the way, is that you can wear your baby in a sling, which is great. But if you, at the same time you're staring at your phone, then you're not learning to read your baby's signals. So, again, this whole question of raising kids with secure attachment is not about being with them 24/7 or hovering. It's about paying attention.
All right. So in our last couple of minutes, let's hit a couple of things with Peter that we haven't even gotten to. And there's more in the book that we're not going to be able to get to this hour. It's called The Attachment Effect, and it's out now. On the subject of our relationships as we age, Peter, I think about maybe it's because I'm thinking about my own family, and it's hard for me not to think about my parents and aging and possible loss and the challenges therein. And that's when I think secure attachment or earned secure really pays off, because when you deal with loss, it can be so difficult, I think, in different ways, you know, for people in who have different sort of profiles of attachment. How do you feel about that?
Well, I write about the book. I write in the book about my own dad's final illness and death at age 96, and watching him go through that process and coming to understand that he probably had a secure attachment, and seeing how that helped him through those that final year. People with secure attachment tend to take care of their health better than others, and I saw my dad do that as long as he could. They tend to follow doctor's orders. And when they're faced with ultimate loss, they just have more resilience and a better acceptance of the facts, you know, and are willing to deal with things in a realistic way. So I was very inspired to watch my dad go through that process.
I also found myself admiring your father for at least having the conversation with you about what happened when you were an infant, when he was essentially doing a lot of the caregiving for you and answering questions from you that might have been tough.
Yeah, and I start the book by going to my dad, who was then, I think, 94, 95, and I felt I had a slender thread left to finally understand what went on when I was very little, and he was my primary caregiver, and he was willing to talk about those things. Which I was very, very grateful for.
Yeah, there are conversations that we can still have to try to understand what happened in our own childhood, because obviously we don't really have memories of those first 24 months. But there's a lot of impact here. The book is The Attachment Effect, and ultimately, what do you hope your readers will take out of this, Peter?
I hope readers will come to understand that we all have attachment styles that influence us in virtually every relationship in our lives, and that it's important for each of us to learn our own attachment style so we can better understand our behavior in relationships and improve those relationships. And finally, I think it's important for people who are raising children to appreciate the importance of how we care for them, particularly in the first couple years, because we are helping form their attachment styles that will influence them for the rest of their lives.
I'll close with an email from a listener named Joel who says, I still love In the Neighborhood and feel that Michael Pollan's work, especially his purchase and slaughter of a cow or two in the book The Omnivore's Dilemma, is derivative of Peter's earlier work. He's giving you credit for Michael Pollan, one of the best-selling authors in the last
well,
decade.
Yeah, he's conflating two of my books there. The book he's referring to is Portrait of a Burger as a Young Calf, where I did buy a calf at birth and follow it through the whole production cycle.
See?
Thank you very much.
See, there you go. No, I think he's saying he loved that. He also loved In the Neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And now the book is The Attachment Effect, Exploring the Powerful Ways Our Earliest Bond Shapes Our Relationships and Lives. Peter Loewenheim is going to be at the Pittsford Barnes & Noble Wednesday night at 7 p.m. where you can get the book. Where else can you get the book?
You can get the book on Amazon and all the other places that books are sold.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thanks, Evan. It's great to be back.
It's always great conversation with you. And by the way, I drag Peter in for other conversations once in a while, and you always say yes, and you're always generous with your time, so thank you for that.
You're a great interview. I love to be here.
Yeah, now we have to go. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Enjoy this gorgeous afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.